Mark Lewison, and this is Hornsey Road, and yes, that title will be explained later. It's a celebration of the Beatles album Abbey Road for its 50th anniversary, and as you can see, there's something of a zebra crossing theme about the evening. I can even do this. I can even do this. And the clothes I am modelling tonight have been manufactured by the makers of Belisha Beatles. Black, white and orange. The only trouble with dressing like this is that people think they can walk all over you. Terrible joke. Okay, so I was going to say, does anybody here want to know anything about the Beatles? Good, me too. And these are, having pressed it too early, these are some books that I've written. I'm a person who writes about the Beatles, not just the Beatles, but these are the books that I have written. And some big ones very near the top there called Tune In. There's a big one and a really big one. That is the first volume of a 3-volume history that I'm writing that will tell the entire Beatles history. A massive project that I'm engaged with. And for those who are waiting for volume 2, yes, it really is coming. Don't worry, it is being written and it will be published. But I just needed to do this tour first. This is a bit of volume 3, actually. So, I brought a few things along. Does anybody know what that smell in the house is, by the way? Can you smell it? Yeah? Okay, well, it's incense sticks. And not just any old incense stick, it's these. These are special Durbar Agarbatti sticks. Now, in 1966, George Harrison and the Beatles went to India to study the sitar under Ravi Shankar. And Ravi was burning these incense sticks. They were his particular personal favourite. And they became, in an instant, George Harrison's favourite as well. And for the rest of his life, from that point on, he had them regularly shipped over from India. And from 1967, George would burn them at every Beatles recording session. So, in the blurb for this tour, I wrote that I would be taking people back to the Abbey Road album in sight and sound and smell. And this is the smell of the Abbey Road album being recorded. What you're smelling tonight is the smell of the recording studio when Abbey Road was made, as well as Sgt. Pepper and the White Album and other things like that. So that's what we're smelling. Now, I've got a few other things here that I want to show you. That red chair is from Abbey Road Studios, gifted to me by the management when I wrote the Beatles Recording Sessions book about 30 years ago. You will see that chair or others very much like it in some of the photographs that I'm going to be showing you on screen tonight. It's the musician's chair, basically, at Abbey Road. What else have I got? I've got the new box set. This is a beautiful new box set that Apple, the Beatles company Apple, has put out. This was number one the week before last. So I thought I was going to be presenting a historical talk, but it turns out that it's a contemporary talk. This is about a number one album of the moment. What else do I have? I have a silver hammer. You know what that's for. And an original, authentic, old 1960s 10 bob note. And I'm sure some of you can tell me where I can stick that. Packet of 10 and 20 Everest cigarettes, menthol cigarettes from the 1960s, all will be revealed later. There's a book called Sun King and a tin of McVitie's biscuits, that's quite important. And this is an original, authentic and very heavy 1960s Philips cassette recorder in working condition. And again, this will come into the evening story later on with an original Philips tape as well. A C60 Philips tape. And I want to talk about this. This is the Beatles Rock Band video game, not an authentic 60s item, but it came out about 10 years ago. It's a PlayStation game. And the reason I'm showing you this is because when this was compiled, in order for the game to be played, all the Beatles' musical tracks for the Abbey Road album were broken down into their component parts. So the bass guitar was separated from the lead, from the rhythm, lead vocals, backing vocals, drums, keyboards, and so on, all were encoded within this game in their isolated form. And the very next day after this was released 10 years ago, some clever person with a computer broke into the coding and all these tracks tumbled out, enabling people like me, great enthusiasts for the Beatles, to hear the Beatles in a way they hadn't ever heard them before, with everything isolated. Well, in the show tonight, I'm going to be playing you the Abbey Road album as released, but in a way that you haven't heard it before, because it's been newly remixed for this show by me in order to expose the working methods of the Beatles, because they weren't legends or icons, as everyone would always tell you these days. They were just guys in a band. They wrote their own songs, they took them into the studio, and they had to record them. And in the recording of them, they just laid down their parts in the way that anybody else would. And I'm going to be isolating some of those parts so you can actually get a better sense of them as musicians and not as legends or icons or anything like that, but just as guys. So thanks to that rock band video game. I'm going to be standing over here mostly. And to begin with, since this is a 1969 story, I'm going to take you back in a real quick crash course to how they got to 1969 before I then go forward. And it all starts here in 1958. Extraordinary colour photograph of George, John and Paul at a McCartney family party in Liverpool, taken by Paul's brother Mike. And at this time, John is the leader of the group. He's 17 years and 5 months. He's invited Paul McCartney to join him. He's 15 years and 9 months. And George is the baby of the band, 15 years old exactly, 9 months younger than Paul, which, as George would say later in life, Paul continually reminded him about that 9-month gap. But John is obviously the oldest. He started this band, they joined his group, he's the leader. And this is then the first ever photograph of them together happens to be colour, and there wouldn't be another colour picture of them for some years. They don't yet know this guy. This is young Richie Starkey, a drummer, already playing in Liverpool groups, skiffle groups mostly, and then rock and roll. He's a couple of months older than John, and they will get to know him when the Beatles go to Hamburg in 1960, and he's out there with his group, so that's where they meet him. Okay, so that's them in 1958. Now, moving swiftly on, 4 years later, they're here.
It's only begun to the people!
Time the Beatles have been recording for 6 years from 1962, and in that time done 180 tracks, an average of 30 tracks a year. And they're not just any old tracks, they are tracks that have completely dragged popular music from this fairly simplistic thing at the beginning of the 1960s to what it was at the end of the 60s, and pretty much is how we still know it today. These are songs that have sold in literally hundreds of millions of copies right around the world, and progress popular music dramatically. And they released on a host of number one singles and these albums, from Please Please Me through to the White Album at the end of 1968. So that's where they're at the end of 1968, and here they are in the year we're looking at, 1969. This was going to be the cover of their first album of 1969. This was going to be the cover of Get Back. In the end, it never came out like this, not with that cover, not with that title. It became the Let It Be album. And the wrinkle of the last two Beatles albums is that they came out in the wrong order. The penultimate one to be recorded, this one, Get Back, Let It Be, came out last. And the last one they recorded, Abbey Road, the last one they ever did together, came out penultimately. And that's always caused a confusion. And this was going to be an album of recordings from January 69, when the Beatles had actually got together to make a TV special. In late 68, they released the White Album, 30 tracks on the last week of November. 5 weeks later, they gathered to shoot or to rehearse for a TV special. Any other band would think, well, obviously, they're going to be rehearsing those songs on the new album. But for the Beatles, 5 weeks was a very long time. And the album said, well, that's 5 weeks ago, why don't we record another album? So in that month, in January 69, they recorded another album. And that's what this was, except it didn't come out this way. And the reason it was, the reason they shot that cover was to actually kind of show how far they had come from the first picture, the one on the left here, the cover of their first album, Please Please Me, in 1963. Then, when they were first having number one hits, they were 20 to 22 years old. And now, having done so much, having led such extraordinary lives, and really, literally changed our world, they were the grand ages of 26 to 28. Somebody did remark to me once that he thought that as a child, when he first saw these pictures compared side by side, that the guys on the right were the fathers of the young men on the left. Which I quite like the idea of. So the Get Back album didn't come out in that form, but it was recorded in the month of January 69, not an entirely happy month, because George walked out for a while, because he wasn't quite content with the way things were going, but he did return. And they were joined for the last few days of the sessions by an American keyboard player called Billy Preston, who they'd known for some years. And the month is best remembered for what happened on the 30th of January, when they went up onto the roof of their Apple building in London, in Mayfair in London, and played about 40 minutes, a live kind of lunchtime session, out to the wind. And out. They couldn't be seen because they were up on the roof, but they could most certainly be heard through that part of central London. Here's just a little bit of that, the Beatles and Billy Preston on the roof. In just those 6 years, done a double album, already recorded another one. And it turns out during the month of January, whilst making Get Back / Let It Be, they had most of the songs for the Abbey Road album as well already written. They're all, 12 of them are actually heard in some early form during the sessions for that month. Well, the first one that they recorded was I Want You, and that was actually for this original project. What became Abbey Road hadn't yet evolved into that, and they were still working towards that January project, when in February they got together and recorded I Want You, with Billy Preston again. I'm going to play you that in the new mix that I've made. And the reason I'm playing I Want You first is because the running order of the album is very much a kind of creative decision that happens towards the end of a project. You get everything together and then you decide the order. So for this talk, as similarly the way I write my books, I'm just looking at the events as they unfolded. So here is the first one they recorded, and it's I Want You. Studio in Soho. Not everything on the Abbey Road album was recorded at Abbey Road. Well, I'm going to be looking now with each of the songs where we first see a Beatle at the composer, looking at their life in that year. So that was a John Lennon song. And here is a little bit of background into John Lennon in 1969. And the overwhelming headline of that year for John is that he and Yoko are completely inseparable. Everywhere that he goes, she goes, and everywhere that she goes, he goes. They are John and Yoko, all one word, and they are never seen apart. And this is their first full year together. They got together in May 1968, and it's a hectic year, a really dramatic year in their lives. And it really begins with, or is overshadowed by the event depicted in this picture here, which is John's drawing of the time in October 68 when the police came knocking on his door in London and busted him for the possession of cannabis, and definitely, unquestionably, brought some of their own just to make sure that they didn't go away without an arrest, because they didn't want the embarrassment of busting the people and going away without having found anything. Not, of course, that John was without cannabis anyway, but they just wanted to make sure. Here, I found this in the London Metropolitan Archives. Here is the charge sheet from Marylebone Magistrates Court in London. Bottom two entries there for John Winston Lennon, age 28, musician, and Yoko Ono Cox, age 34, artist. And John took the rap for this because Yoko didn't have a British passport, and he feared that she would be deported if she was found guilty of a crime. And therefore he took the rap, and this is what came to drag his early 1970s. Between 1972 and 76, the American government was continually harassing John Lennon, trying to kick him out of living in America on the basis of his London drugs conviction that we see here. Here they are outside the courthouse that day, and they're basically being harassed. They're being harassed by the establishment. They've been deliberately busted, planted as well, and they're being harassed because John is being so outspoken now. He always had been, but he's particularly outspoken with Yoko. And it's probably no coincidence that the bust occurred in the days after the first publication of the two virgins' photographs, which were in the newspapers the preceding weekend. Private Eye managed to marry together the photographs with the bust, with Beatle-held sensation, and trotting out the old schoolboy joke, it's no good, officer, it won't stand up in court. And covering his private there, member of the British Empire. Although actually not for much longer, because he would be returning his medal late in 1969. And I also like all human filth is here, including Robert Maxwell. So here is the Beatles' rest and relaxation room in their office at Apple in Mayfair. And as you can see, they just have to adjust to the fact that John and Yoko are completely inseparable. He had been married to his art school sweetheart, Cynthia. They had a son, Julian, but that's all over now. He's now with Yoko, and he's getting a divorce from Cynthia. And when that divorce comes through, and Yoko's divorce comes through from her husband, they get married. And if you know the song, The Ballad of John and Yoko, it's basically about 2 weeks of their life in spring 1969, which begins with them being married in Gibraltar near Spain, and then goes on to this. This is John and Yoko's first begging for peace in the Amsterdam Hilton Hotel. Like all honeymooners, they wanted to spend the week in bed, but they knew that whatever they did would be front page news, and therefore they would use that as an event and try and sell something with it. And what they were selling was the idea of peace. John had the idea of selling it like a commercial, we'd do a commercial for peace. He didn't have, as people criticised him, because he couldn't explain how peace could be attained, as if anyone knows that answer. But the message from John and Yoko was, we need to think peace, let's have more peaceful thoughts, let's demonstrate for peace, let's demonstrate against war. This is our way of doing it. We're in bed, we're talking to journalists and reporters, we're giving our message across sincerely, but you can do your own thing. And they were trying to encourage everybody to give peace a chance. They were roundly ridiculed for this. The whole world laughed at this. Nobody saw their point of view. They just thought they were mad. And they thought they were even more mad at the end of the week when, as the song says, they went to Vienna and did a press conference in a bag in the Hotel Sasha. That's John and Yoko encased in a white sheet in the middle of that picture. And this is to explain a concept of theirs called bagism. Now, bagism meant, essentially, if we're encased in a bag, you can't see us, you can't see what colour skin we've got, you can't see anything about us, and therefore you can't be prejudiced against us. So it's trying to open people's eyes to how rife prejudice is. Prejudice, is there a word? Yes, anyway, you know what I mean. So And everybody laughed at this too, of course. Everyone thought this was completely stupid. I mean, as if the whole world could go around in white sheets. They knew that it was impractical too, but it was a concept, and it was an interesting one at that. They knew too they were being laughed at, and when they got back to London at the end of this trip to Vienna, John explained in an interview what it was they were doing.
And we are humorous, Laurel and Hardy, that's John and Yoko, and we stand a better chance under that guise, because all the serious people like Martin Luther King and Kennedy and Gandhi got shot.
Yeah, funny and then not so funny, right? When you consider the events of 11 years later. So, that's the wedding and that's Baggism, and then they do a second wedding for peace in Montreal. John wants to do it in America, but the American government won't let him in because of that drugs bust. So he goes to Canada, he and Yoko go to Canada, to Montreal, and they broadcast back across the border because it's the Vietnam War time. And it's a time of great radicalism, and they're really protesting against the war, like a lot of students are on campuses in America. So John broadcasts back to America from Montreal, and whilst there, writes these lyrics for a song. And this will become Give Peace a Chance. He's already written All You Need Is Love in 1967. 2 years after this, in 1971, he will write Imagine. This is his peace anthem, All You Need Is Love. And it was recorded in the hotel suite in Montreal during the wedding. Here's a little bit of that. Because the Beatles always had a lot going on in their lives. Other acts, other bands may well just parcel off a period of time and say, well, we're going to be recording an album now, we won't do anything else, we'll just focus on that. But the Beatles always led extremely busy lives, and that is all going on whilst Abbey Road is being recorded. The whole peace campaign thing happens at the same time as the Abbey Road album for John and Yoko. So that's John. Now let's have a look at George Harrison. Here he is in the greenhouse of his bungalow in Esher in Surrey. And in 1969, this was George Harrison's big problem. Here are those 180 songs that we saw listed earlier. And of those, 24 of them were cover versions recorded in the early days. George has written just 17 of them, and Lennon and McCartney have bagged 136. Now, there's no doubt that the Beatles' great fame and wealth, their popularity, owed to the songs of Lennon and McCartney, because they were such brilliant songs, and really, they wrote all the number ones, they wrote the film songs, they wrote everything, really, that got the Beatles where they were. But George would only ever be able to get one or two songs of his onto any one album, because that's all they would kind of allow him. In fact, Lennon and McCartney had a bit of a problem, too, with this credit, because they hit upon this idea informally in 1962, that whoever wrote the song, either John or Paul, they would always put both their names on it. And by this time, 1969, everyone thinks they're like Rodgers and Hammerstein, where one writes the music and one writes the lyrics. And they kind of want to shake that off. So that's beginning to evolve in itself. But George's problem is that he's only been able to get 17 songs onto all those records that the Beatles have released. Here is a list of songs written by George after spring 1969, including a film soundtrack and a couple of other pieces as well. Basically, 20 songs he's written in 6 years. But then something happens to George. At the end of 1968, he goes to America, he meets Bob Dylan and the band, and somehow or other a tap is turned, and he knows from that point on how to start and finish a song in one sitting. And suddenly, like that, he's got 17 more songs up his sleeve at the start of 1969, and within a few more weeks, by the late spring, he's got another 15. So he's got 32 songs. He's now as prolific as John and Paul. And there's no way, if he only gets two or three on an album, that he's ever going to be able to get through those. Not at the rate he's now writing. So he's already talking of doing an album just of his songs. Whilst the Beatles are together, George is already thinking he'll just do a solo album. But at this point, he puts forward only 3 songs for the Beatles. There's no point in putting forward any more because he knows they won't be all recorded. He puts forward Old Brown Shoe, which is the B-side of John's record, The Ballad of John and Yoko. He puts forward Here Comes the Sun, And the next one that we're going to hear now in the show, Sam.
No, let's get one out. Do you want me to do that? I can do it.
George just kind of took the opening line of that song, didn't take anything else, but he just used that as a springboard for him to write a song. The ironic thing about that being that James Taylor had wanted to call that song I Feel Fine, and couldn't because it had already been taken by Lennon and McCartney for the Beatles. Well, in 1969, when George spoke about something, he said that the song was about his wife Patty, a model Patty Boyd. Here she is on the day that she met George Harrison, in 1964, on the train that was a set of A Hard Day's Night. Here they are 2 years later on their wedding day, January 1966. And here they are in 1968. Very beautiful woman, Patty. But in later years, much to her distress, George actually took that away from Patty and said that really the song was actually written with Ray Charles in mind. Doesn't quite make sense, something in the way she moves. The tracks be like No Other Lover. Not quite Ray Charles there. But what he really meant, I think, was that he had Ray Charles in his mind when he wrote it in terms of its kind of musical structure, its groove. And I found out that the week he wrote it, in September 68, George and his great mate Eric Clapton went together to see Ray Charles at the Royal Festival Hall. And that's why he wrote it with Ray in mind, because he was going to see Ray, and with that in his head he just kind of framed the song that kind of was a bit Ray Charles-ish. But I'm sure it was really about Patty as well. And it was at that particular show that George spied on stage, assisting Ray during the show, a young keyboard player called Billy Preston, who the Beatles had known from their Hamburg days. And that's how Billy came to be involved with the Beatles through from January through to about May of 1969. Well, here's where George and Patty are living. This is the bungalow in Esher that I mentioned. It was a millionaire's bungalow as it then was, but really nothing like one would be today. Quite drab, actually, but George took to decorating it on the outside. So if you went to visit him, you might be given a paintbrush and a pot and invited to make a contribution. In fact, if you look in the bottom left picture there, it says Mick and Marianne were here. That's Mick Jagger and Marianne Faithfull. The Beatles much closer to the Stones than we ever knew in the 1960s. In fact, in the fisheye picture that's bottom right there, the man closest to George, just to the right of George's head, that's Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, who would become, in July 1969, the first rock star casualty of the period when he was found dead in his swimming pool in Sussex. And the Beatles knew Brian Jones very well. Well, like John, like Paul, like Ringo, George did some recreational soft drugs, marijuana particularly. They've been smoking it since Bob Dylan turned them on in 1964. And I found this little clip of a recording session in January 1969 of George requesting something from the baby to help him make the session go with a swing. And a joint if you've got me, he says to the roadie, and that isn't to get wrecked, that's just to kind of relax into the session and let the creative juices flow. But the consequence of George also being a cannabis marijuana smoker was that he too, in March 1969, fell foul of the law. He was busted as well, and again the police brought some of their own to be on the safe side, claiming to have found a huge piece of cannabis resin in a boot in his wardrobe. And here's George and Patty at the courthouse on the day that he was fined £500. In fact, she was fined too, both given a criminal record. And George was really incensed about this. He wasn't a dealer, he was just smoking it in the privacy of his own house. But now he too has a criminal record. Particularly like the woman in the red coat looking in through the back window. The Beatles were very popular with old ladies. The history books will tell you, and the old clips you see on television would always show screaming teenage girls running after the Beatles. And that's true, of course, but they definitely had a great fan following amongst older people. Because when they came through in 1963, they were such fresh-faced, engaging, good-looking young men, singing great, catchy pop songs. And they developed this following very quickly amongst all generations, including particularly old women. So there she is, and I think she's actually the sister of this old woman who looking through the window of the train when they were making a hard day's night 5 years earlier. They were probably discussing the Beatles on the phone that night together, seeing if they were still the same as they was before they was. They always had to sign autographs too. Everywhere they went, always a request for autographs, and in the courthouse this day, George signed this one. Best wishes from a criminal, George Harrison, written, I think, with a lot of anger in his hand. And he said to the Sunday Times a few days later, with reference to the fact that the police had found this big stash in his boots, he said, "Look, I'm a tidy man. I keep my socks in the sock drawer and stash in the stash box. So that wasn't mine," is what he was saying. But the consequence of George being busted is that, like John Lennon, he had his American visa taken away. So now, only 5 years after the Beatles have landed in America and completely revolutionized their popular culture, two of the Beatles can no longer even get into the country. So that's what's happening for George. One other thing too, before I move on, and that is that he was a record producer at the same time. He had a hit record with Billy Preston called That's the Way God Planned It. Said it was a hit. Here is the NME Top 30 chart for the week of July 23rd, 1969. Any questions? That's the Way God Planned It is at number 6. So right in the time when the Beatles are making Abbey Road, George is the top, is a producer of a record that's in the top 10 of the charts. He's a hit producer. Also in the charts, number 3, Give Peace a Chance by the Plastic Ono Band. I'll be coming back to that name shortly. And at number 13, like some Alan Freeman here, don't I? Number 13, Pop Pickers, Ballad of John and Yoko by the Beatles, which had been number 1 and was now on its way down. I could actually do a whole show just on this chart. I'm not going to do that, but I've just mentioned that Honky Tonk Women by the Stones, this week at number 1, is the last number 1 record they've had in this country to this day, 50 years ago. Well, here is George in his bungalow in Isha, and you can see he's burning his incense stick there, his special durbar agarbatti. So again, the smell in the room is not just the Beatles recording session, but it's also you're inside George's bungalow, if you can still smell it now. And he was very welcoming of the pioneer members of the Hare Krishna movement who came to England from San Francisco in 1968 with the twin purpose of meeting the Beatles and getting their own temple in London. They did meet the Beatles. Both John and George allowed the Krishnas to live with them in 1969, and they did get their own temple as well. And George went on to produce a hit record for them later in the year. And that thing right at the back, up against the wall, looks like an old telephone switchboard. That is a Moog synthesizer. The coming of electronic music is here, and that will be the dominant sound through the first half of the 1970s with prog rock. Well, George was one of the first to get a synthesizer in the UK. And in fact, again at this time, whilst making Abbey Road, he releases an album of synthesizer sounds called Electronic Sound on the Beatles' own Zappel record label. So that's George Harrison's life at this time. But there's another George in the Beatles' world, of course, and that is this man, who they called Big George Martin. And he had signed the Beatles to their record company, EMI, in 1962. And here he is with them in April 1963, presenting them with their first ever silver record for Please Please Me, the single. And these were happy days for George Martin, and his job as producer was really to kind of organise them in the studio, to actually tell them when to come in, how many songs were needed, make sure that they actually got them down in time. And he was like a schoolmaster to them. They ribbed him, but there was a respectful relationship. They spoke their mind, they were always the Beatles, but George Martin was kind of in charge, and that was his function as record producer. But by the time this picture is taken in 1967, George is only nominally in charge. They're telling him what they want. They've sold those hundreds of millions of records by this time. And they're telling him, you can actually see in this picture, what we want you to do, George, is this. And George had become a perfect equal with them in the recording studio. And he would realise whatever it was that they needed. They would tell him and he would actually kind of make it happen for them. You can actually see it on my red chair there. I think you can make that out. Yeah. However, things were changing. Because at the end of 1968, as the Beatles were concluding the recording of their White Album, George Martin went on holiday and missed 17 of the last 32 sessions, and the Beatles carried on without him. It no longer mattered to them whether he was there or not, because they knew what to do. They were intimately familiar with how to record by this point and how to achieve the sounds. There was a young apprentice and a producer called Chris Thomas, who was there if they needed that extra pair of ears, but basically they were content to work without George Martin, and if he went away, they didn't bother stopping. And that was the start of something that changed. It was in January 1969 when they were making the Get Back, Let It Be album. George Martin was in and out, but they were really using an engineer producer, a young guy called Glyn Johns, who was on his way up. And it didn't matter again whether George Martin was there or not. And in April, when they were recording 10 sessions, and I think George Martin was absent for all of them. So the sessions are still being booked through his office. So he knows about them, but he knows they don't want him there. And George Martin is now thinking that that's it for him, that they don't want him anymore, and maybe they never will want him again, and he's going to have to, you know, move on from the Beatles. Here's a graphic to show you very quickly. Here's the Hey Jude Revolution single, the Beatles' first record on their own Apple record label in August 68. There's a credit for George Martin. But when they do the Get Back, Don't Let Me Down single, there is no producer credit at all. And when they do the Ballad of Johnny Yoko and Old Brown Shoe, again, no producer credit for George Martin. So he's thinking that as far as he's concerned, that's it between him and the Beatles. Well, they carry on recording without George Martin, and the next number you're going to hear, the next in the sequence, is the first Paul McCartney song we're going to hear, and that is Over.
Oh, darling, please believe me.
She had been Paul's girlfriend from 1963, to 1968. They never got married. There were endless rumors of them being about to marry, but they never actually happened. These look like their wedding day photographs. They're actually from when Paul was the best man at his brother Mike's wedding. In fact, just a few weeks after these were taken, they were broken up. And Paul was getting it together with this woman, Linda Eastman. She was an American photographer over in London in 1967. She took a lot of rock photographs, and she was over, and she ended up at this event. This is the private launch party for the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album, held by Brian Epstein, the Beatles' manager, at his house. And that evening, she took this picture of Paul McCartney, and then went back to New York and had it developed and posed her young daughter, Heather. Linda was a divorcee. This, her young daughter, Heather, mooning for Paul in this photograph, and then sent that over to Paul, which he really liked. And for that reason, and no doubt others as well, Paul and Linda got together. She came over to London at the end of the making of the White Album in September 1968. And here they are on the street outside Paul's house in St. John's Wood. The other three Beatles lived in Surrey, southwest of London, but Paul lived 5 minutes walk from the recording studio at Abbey Road, and could always get there easily, just a very short hop. And here is Paul and Linda outside their house. Now, she was, Paul always had a lot of girl fans outside his house because he was there in London and because he was always the most popular Beatle for girls. And he had a good rapport with these girls. He would talk to them, he would pose for photographs, he would sign autographs for them and actually kind of check their welfare and make sure that they, you know, they were okay and fed and all of that. These girls just about tolerated Jane because she was a kind of English rose. But they really, really detested Linda Eastman, because she was American and they didn't like her. And they were really nasty to her, in fact. Both John and Paul had something in common at this time, and that was that both of their partners were being abused whenever they went anywhere. Yoko was called a Jap, would you believe, by the British newspapers in 1968-69. And they were shouted at everywhere they went, and so too were Paul and Linda. Everywhere they went, people were really nasty to her, and therefore she naturally was nasty back to them. And every time Paul and Linda had to come and go through the front of their house, they would have to kind of ride all these horrible things were being shouted at them. But in fact, the house was graffiti with a lot of anti-Linda stuff. Here is some graffiti. I don't have pictures of the bad stuff, but the house was graffiti. They always had to see that as they came and went. So for that reason, amongst others, Linda was very keen to get out of London, and when Paul took her up to his place in Scotland on the Mull of Kintyre, she was completely at home there, and in the 1970s would try to encourage Paul to spend a lot more of his life away from London, where they could have the seclusion that they needed as a new couple. And here is Paul with his now becoming stepdaughter Heather, and also his famous old dog Martha the sheepdog. Well, in March 1969, the same day that George and Patsy were busted, that we saw earlier, Paul and Linda were married at Marylebone Register office in London. And I've got a little bit of film of that just to give you a sense of how hemmed in the Beatles still were whenever they were out in public and the public knew where they were going to be. So here's a little bit of that. And also listen out to one of our favourite old ladies who couldn't see a darn thing.
It feels fine, thank you. What are you going to do? Is it going to change your life much, do you think?
I don't know, really. I've never been married before.
They always have such brilliant answers. Well, when Paul married Linda, he married into her family, and the man on the left that we see here is her father, Lee Eastman. The man on the right, that's Linda's brother, John Eastman. And together, father and son, they were Eastman and Eastman, prominent New York attorneys with clients in the art world, and some involvement in the music business as well. And Paul wanted them to come and have a look at the Beatles company, Apple, because they did need someone to actually have a look at their contractual affairs and tell them what position they were in. But the other three Beatles were never that mad about having the Eastmans around, not because at this point they were anti-Eastmans, though that would happen. But in particular, they just knew that it wasn't right for the family of any one of them to have an involvement in the business side of things. nonetheless, they are there to an extent. I mentioned that Paul is a stepfather to Heather. Here they are on holiday in France in May 1969, again during the recording of the Wax album. And it's also in the newspapers that Paul is going to become a father at Christmas time when Linda is going to give birth. That would be 9 months after the March wedding. So when the baby came along in August, a little bit of revision of the arithmetic had to happen. Paul was completely bossing the British charts at this time. Everything he did was turning to gold. Here is the number one spot on the NME Top 30 chart from September 68 to January 1969. And Hey Jude, which was a huge selling record for the Beatles, written and sung by Paul McCartney, actually was only 3 weeks at number one, because it was knocked off the top by an even bigger selling record, which was Those Were the Days by Mary Hopkin. She was a young Welsh singer who was Paul McCartney's protege at the Beatles' new Apple record label. And he chose that song for her and produced it. And everybody knew that, that was very much a Paul McCartney song. And that was number one for 5 weeks on the chart, until it was knocked off the top by a cover version by Joe Cocker, a great cover of the Beatles With a Little Help from My Friends, which was written by John and Paul. And then in January 69, 2 weeks at number one for another McCartney song, not by the Beatles, but by the Marmalade, Over the Deep, Over the Dark. And into that gap between November and January actually fell Paul's brother, Mike, who was in the Scaffold, kind of novelty trio, the Scaffold, and their great record, Living the King. So the McCartney boys, the two brothers, are completely bossing the number one spot on the British chart for about 4 months there at the end of 1968, beginning of 1969. Well, the one Beatle we haven't heard from so far in the show is Ringo, and his song on the album is Octopus's Garden. And I wanted to find a recording of Ringo speaking about it from 1969. And the only one I was able to find is actually from Radio Luxembourg. And if anyone in the room remembers the ordeal of listening to Radio Luxembourg, as the sound ebbed and flowed at 208 metres on the medium wave, you'll understand why this is slightly lo-fi. Nonetheless, I think he can make out what he's saying. So here's Ringo explaining his song.
Well, it all came about one fine afternoon on holiday, and the guy was telling me a story about octopuses and how they make gardens. And it knocked me out so much that I just wrote this song about it. How do octopuses make gardens? Well, they go down the seabed and they pick up all the shiny things and nice things, and the seabed's nothing in front of them, you know, which is fantastic. And so I thought, well, that's nice, and I'd like to go there. Yeah, I'm sure a few of my friends would like to go there, and that's what the song's all about. It's like children's because it's very simple words and nothing complicated. It's just a nice little song, and I'm very proud of it.
I think I went to, I asked my friend earlier, or you all came late.
In an octopus's garden in the shade. He let us in, knows where we've been, in his octopus's garden in the shade.
The end of 1968, in October in fact, Sellers allowed Ringo the use of his yacht that was moored off the coast of Sardinia. And here is Ringo on the yacht in an early selfie. I think two pictures jumped there. But anyway, that's his son Zach in the rubber ring there, the life raft. Zach, who went on to become drummer in The Who, a great drummer in his own right. And the story that Ringo told of the octopus picking up shiny bits, that actually came about from the period on the yacht. One day the chef had cooked squid for lunch, And Ringo, who had been very ill as a child, nearly died on two separate occasions, could only eat plain food. So he said, I can't possibly eat that, take it away. And the captain said, well, actually, octopuses are very beautiful creatures. They gather around, they gather shiny objects and create gardens on the seabed. And Ringo thought that was so beautiful that he wrote a song. He had just become a songwriter with a track called Don't Pass Me By on the Beatles' White Album, and this was his second song. Well, Ringo and Serge were great mates at this time, and in fact, they were making a film together. You may have seen the handwritten lyric for this song was on the notepaper of The Magic Christian, and that was the name of the film that they were making through the spring of 1969. So Ringo isn't only a musician and composer, he's also acting in a movie. And the film had a great cast: Peter Sellers, Richard Attenborough, John Lemessurier, John Cleese, Spike Milligan, and Ringo. But it was a really terrible film. A really shockingly bad film. And if you get the chance to see it, don't. But that's what Ringo was doing. As well as recording with the Beatles, he was making this movie through to the late spring of 1969. And he's a family man. Here he is at home with his wife Maureen and son Zach, who we just saw, and also baby Jason. He's the only Beatle with two children. And he's living in deep Surrey, beyond Guildford, in a place called Elstead, in a house that he bought from Peter Sellers. So the next album, the next track I'm going to play you from the album is You Never Give Me Your Money, and I'll tell you the story of that one after it's played. Here he is in August 1966, overseeing their second appearance at Shea Stadium in New York City. But his death 1 year later, in August 1967, caused the Beatles to have to really look at their business affairs for the first time, because Brian had always taken care of everything. And in fact, at the time of his death, they had already formed their own company, Apple Corps, which was their big idea for this kind of like a foundation of the arts. Here is the Apple building on Savile Row, right there, with a great green Granny Smith flag flying over the doorway, much as the Apple shop around the corner on Regent Street now has a flag flying over its doorway. So Apple Computers didn't only nick the name Apple from the Beatles, they nicked the flag as well. But the Beatles, Apple was already a mess by the end of 1968 because it had diversified far too quickly And they actually did try to get this man to come in and streamline things for them, this Lord Beeching, who had decimated Britain's railway network in 1963, and that's what the Beatles felt they needed at Apple. But Beeching took one look at it and just kind of thought, no, I'll leave you to this one yourself, too much bother. I mentioned that Eastman and Eastman were already involved, but not entirely to the pleasure of the other three Beatles. And then things changed fundamentally in January 69, when John Lennon gave this interview to Disc and Music Echo, which was one of Britain's four weekly music papers at that time. In this interview, John said that we haven't got half the money that people think we have. We have enough to live on, but we can't let Apple go on like it is. Apple is losing money every week because it needs close to be running by a big businessman. And in the last little section there that I highlighted, he says, Apple doesn't need to make vast profits, but if it carries on like this, all of us will be broke in the next 6 months. Well, this made major headlines, and those headlines attracted the attention of this man, Alan Klein, who was a New York accountant who had become business manager for quite a few acts in the music business. The Beatles knew him as the guy who ran the Stones business affairs, and actually quite envied the way that he looked after the Stones for quite some time. Here he is, when Mick and Keith were busted with possession of marijuana in 1967 in Chichester in Sussex. Well, he set up a meeting with John Lennon at the Dorchester Hotel in Park Lane, Mayfair, on January the 27th, 1969, and so impressed John and Yoko that very night, in the suite of the Dorchester, John allowed these two letters to be typed. The one on the left is to Dick James. Dick James was the man who ran Northern Songs. Northern Songs was where John and Paul had put all their incredibly valuable song copyrights. And the company had gone public on the stock exchange in 1965, so nobody owned it outright anymore. But Dick James and John Lennon and Paul McCartney owned a substantial block of shares. The second letter on the right is to Sir Joe. That's Sir Joseph Lockwood, the chairman of EMI. Now, John was only one quarter of the Beatles. He couldn't appoint Klein to look after the Beatles. What he's saying in these letters is, Klein is going to be looking after my stuff, and I want you to cooperate with him and do whatever you can. Well, as a result of Klein and getting in with John Lennon, he came into Apple and met the other Beatles. And very soon after that, in fact, straight away, George and Ringo both decided that they would go with Alan Klein instead. They knew that Klein was unconventional. They knew that he was tough. They knew that he was kind of like a bad guy. But there always comes that point in any artist's career when they look around them and see that their money has made other people rich, when they find themselves thinking, we need to have more of our own money for ourselves, and we need a rock buyer to go out there and get it for us. And that was what Clive appointed Alan Klein. But Paul McCartney didn't. He had the Eastmans, they were his in-laws, and he didn't want anybody else to be running them. He tried to make the other Beatles take the Eastmans, they didn't want to know. They tried to make him take Klein, he didn't want to know. And this division occurred between Paul and John, George and Ringo over who would represent them. Here is Alan Klein on the left of this picture with the Beatles' most indispensable aide, Neil Aspinall, who was with them for nearly 50 years. But Klein was in, and here is a piece in the Evening Standard, the London Evening Standard. There are various ways of doing business, and there's Alan Klein's way. And Alan Klein's way was so extreme that the Beatles' business partners to this point all kind of took fright. Here is NEMS Enterprises Limited. That was Brian Epstein's company. The Beatles were hoping to buy NEMS, or possibly even get it for nothing, because it owned a big chunk of their record royalties going forward. But as soon as Klein comes in, the Epstein family sell it instead to a City Investment Trust, and the money that the Beatles are owed gets held up in court, and suddenly that's happening. Klein's company, Abco Industries, became a regular correspondent with the Beatles' record company, EMI. Everybody querying elements of the contract and challenging record royalties and so on. And then the really big one for John and Paul is that the man in the second left in the old photograph, Dick James, the man in the glasses and the hat, he's the Beatles' music publisher. He takes such fright over Alan Klein's arrival that he sells his shares in Northern Songs to Lou Gray of ATV. And there is a battle royal through the entire making of the Abbey Road album over whether John and Paul will be able to regain control of their song copyrights. In fact, at this time, The Beatles are more on the city pages of the newspapers than they are the arts and culture pages. And that's just a reality that it dogs their entire 1969. But Klein's appointment as business manager to Apple is eventually forced through by three of the Beatles. And here is the contract, signed in the bottom right by George, by Ringo, and by John, but of course not by Paul McCartney. And that appointment was ratified at an extraordinary general meeting of Apple held at a recording studio on the 9th of May 1969. Here is the minute of that meeting. The Beatles didn't only record Abbey Road at Abbey Road, as I mentioned. This night they were recording at a studio in Barnes in southwest London called Olympic. But instead of recording, they had this meeting and it was pushed through. Now, the Beatles always had this agreement between them in everything they did that they would only allow unanimous decisions to carry. So that was to ensure that if any one of them was ever unhappy at anything they were deciding, it wouldn't happen, because they respected that person so much that they wouldn't do it. But here, for the first time, the Beatles broke their own code and went with a 3-1 instead of a 4-0. But a few years ago, I was interviewing Paul McCartney, and I asked him specifically about the events of this night, the 9th of May, 69, and he had quite a clear memory of it, and this is a little of what he told me about it.
They showed up at Olympic Barnes. And there was a row, and they all accused me of stalling. I was actually trying to, in my mind, save our future, which it turned out to be, I think, vindicated later. But at the time, I was definitely the dark horse, the problem, you know. They said, you're always looking stalling, I remember John saying, you never want to do anything. I said, this guy's going to take us over. And he's telling me all this. That was actually the night we broke the Beatles, really. That was the big crack in the Liberty Bell. You know, I never been back together after that one. And it was then 3-1. It's Klein and the other guys. Because Ringo and George just said, oh, whatever John does, we're going. So he just got their two votes in everything.
The great crack in the Liberty Bell. So it's the 3-1. And things are never the same. They do carry on recording, they can still work together. The miracle of the Abbey Road album, among so many others, is that it's such an extraordinary, lush, melodic album. And yet outside the studio door, they're having all this hassle constantly, particularly in the 3-1 situation. Well, that night, the three, John, George and Ringo, left the studio. The Beatles didn't do any recording. But Paul stayed behind and went into the other recording room there, where he saw Steve Miller, the American singer-songwriter who was making an album of his own, and in fact had an association with the Beatles' Apple record label anyway. And Paul and Steve Miller basically jammed on a track together, with Paul on drums and vocals, and in honour of what was going on for Paul in this really heavy moment, they called it My Dark Hour. Pseudonym when the Beatles first toured Scotland in 1960. And a few years later, some young American musicians who were in a band were sitting around deciding what they would call their band, and they saw this and decided to call themselves the Ramones. And so everything is kind of related. Well, the combination of all this business hassle, the endless reports on the city pages of disagreements and disputes, combined with John and Yoko's bed into peace and bagism and his drug bust and George's drug bust and their long hair and their beards and everything about them, you know, the magical mystery tour that had been decided that had been a flop, and their episode with the Maharishi, which everyone thought was hilariously funny, that they should actually want to meditate. What on earth is meditation? The consequence of all of this was that by spring 69, quite an element of the British public had actually turned against the Beatles. Not the old ladies, as we've seen, and not people who bought records, but a lot of people in between. And the Beatles have gone terribly funny. They've gone very, very strange. And most of the time the Beatles were recording Abbey Road, there was a constant accompaniment of anti-Beatles pieces in the British press, something that we do quite well in this country, of turning against our heroes and the people who have put our country on the map in the way the Beatles had. There's a whole load of these newspaper pieces. I'm just going to show you one. It appeared in the Daily Mail, written by our then famous columnist called Godfrey Wynne. And the piece was called, If Britain Doesn't Like You Anymore, This Is Why. And here's a little of what Godfrey had to say.
I wonder what your reactions were when you saw all the pictures of one of the Beatles and his Japanese wife giving a public performance on their honeymoon in a hotel bedroom in Amsterdam, followed, as an encore, by another of the Beatles and his wife, head up in court for the discovery of a huge hoard of cannabis resin in their Esher home. What has happened to you? Is it too late for you to take a sharp, severe, new look at yourself? Surely you have no one to blame except yourself that your love affair with the British public should be ending fast in disillusionment and dislike.
I've kind of forgotten now that we had turned against the Beatles in the last year, but that is the reality of it. Except if you were a young person who bought records, singles. Here's 9 consecutive weeks of the NME chart from the end of April to the last week of June 1969. And you can see that still the Beatles are selling records in vast quantities, with Get Back being number one 5 consecutive weeks. And when eventually it's knocked off the top, Out of Johnny Yoko, the Beatles' next single, comes up and replaces it. Well, most of the tracks that we've heard so far had originally been recorded for that Get Back Let It Be project, but that was now being held up in the late spring of 69 because there was going to be a film with it, and that was going to take a while to edit. And also the Beatles wanted to have a book of photographs with it, and that was quite a time-consuming production job as well. So they decided in June 69 to take the tracks they've been recording from I Want You Onwards with Octopus's Garden and Something and Oh Darling, to actually make those the basis for yet another album. They've got one on the shelf, Get Back or Let It Be, and they decide to take those tracks and move forward and create yet another album, and that's where Abbey Road really begins to take shape. And in June 69, they make a decision, two things. One, they will book Abbey Road from the 1st of July for a whole sequence of sessions in order to complete a new album. And the second thing is they decide to get George Martin because it's been a while since they've worked with him, and they now want to work with him once more. And so on behalf of all four Beatles who have agreed it, Paul McCartney makes a phone call to George Martin and says, we want you to come back and record us like you used to do in the old days. The old days being all of, you know, a couple of years back. So George Martin accepts that, and he's going to come back from the 1st of July. Well, with that in mind, they've got just the last few days at the end of June to take care of other business. Here's John and Yoko in their room at Abbey, where they planned all their campaigns and their films and their bed-ins and all their interviews and press conferences. And at this time, they are deciding to release the Plastic Ono, release Give Peace a Chance by the Plastic Ono Band. John is now forming a second band to run in parallel with the Beatles. And Plastic Ono Band is a conceptual band. Doesn't have a constant membership, it's fluid, anyone can be in it. In fact, the commercial, the ads for Give Peace a Chance say that you are the Plastic Ono Band, meaning we are all Plastic Ono Band. And John and Yoko came up with this concept of basically being like loudspeakers and tape recorders and musical equipment instead of musicians. As realized in this photograph here with equipment inside Perspex tubes. Well, with this about to be released and launched, and with the 1st of July sessions coming up fast, the last few days of June, John and his son Julian and Yoko and her daughter Kyoko take off on a road trip around Britain, intending to be back in London for all the work that they're planning. And this is the route that they were taking. John wanted to show Yoko the new love of his life, all the places in his early life that were important to him. He wanted to take her to Wales. He then wanted to drive up across Snowdonia to Liverpool and introduce her to his family and to take her to the cavern where the Beatles had been discovered. And then up through Edinburgh, where he'd had many childhood holidays, and eventually to the very top of Scotland, to Durness, where he had childhood holidays in a croft. And they set out initially in a mini, And I've been able to plot their route by going to the British Library in London, where they have all of Britain's local newspapers historically in bound volumes. And you can find from all the reports where they went. This is in the South Wales Evening Post, Gower Post Office's early customers, Yoko and John. Eventually they get up to Liverpool, where John trades in the Mini for, of all cars, an Austin Maxi. This is going to be their car now for the rest of the trip. This is outside his aunt and uncle's house. He did take Yoko to the cabin. And then they drive up through the Lake District. I was very pleased to find this one a few weeks ago in the Lake District Herald. John making the front page of the local newspaper, filling his car with petrol at a garage in Penrith. So the Beatles aren't light, and John and Yoko, who look really like freaks with their long hair and John's big bushy beard, and nonetheless they are focus of attention everywhere they go and front page news. They get up to Edinburgh, always a request for an autograph there on the Scotch house where they bought the children kilts. Here is a lovely family photograph of John and Yoko with Julian and Kyoko, all dressed up in their kilts, their tartan. Eventually they get up to the very top of Scotland, and here's a photograph of John being asked for yet another autograph. They were always giving autographs through the window of the Austin Maxi, but that's the last time that it looked like this, because a few minutes later, it looked like that. John was driving on the narrow road. He wasn't a brilliant driver anyway. A car came towards him, he panicked and swerved and went into a ditch. And this being 1969, no one was wearing seatbelts. The children were thrown forward, but not too badly hurt. But John and Yoko were quite badly cut. They went straight into the windscreen. Yoko had a gash right across her forehead that required 17 stitches, and John also had a gash that needed stitches in his face. And the consequence was that they were taken to hospital. And here is John at the Lawson Memorial Hospital in Gosby. I know you're bleeding, John, but would you please sign here? And they were detained. So they couldn't get back to London. So the sessions that begin on July the 1st for what becomes the Abbey Road album take place without John Lennon for the next 3 weeks. They work without him, again, like when they work without George Martin. Just because John isn't there, the other three Beatles do work there. But John is now missing because he's detained in hospital in the north of Scotland. Well, here they are. Here is Abbey Road. This is the old house that is still much like you would see it today if you stand on the street and look at it. This is number 3 Abbey Road in St John's Wood, northwest London. Built in the 1830s as a rather desirable villa. And then bought by EMI and turned into a recording studio in 1931. It's now been a recording studio for 88 years. And as I said, if you stand and look at it, it looks something like this still, an old house. The recording rooms are all built in the rear. And the Beatles have been coming here to make their records since 1962. Here they are on the steps of the building in 1963. And you'll notice that the title of the building, its name, is EMI Recording Studio. The Beatles never called it Abbey Road. They only ever said EMI. We're going to EMI tonight, 7 o'clock, see you there. Here is Ringo and George on the steps as they were going to record Short Records Forever in November 1966. EMI. Well, the album that they're making is going to be recorded on this piece of equipment. This is a 3M 8-track analog tape recorder. The Beatles have progressed in recording terms from 2-track to 4-track and now 8-track, but they, unlike today where you know you have an infinite number of tracks, and of course it's well before the age of digital, this is all analog, but the recordings are extremely good quality, and the Beatles used the tape economically. They very rarely needed any more than 8 tracks, and although they could record an album over the span of several months, most of the tracks that they recorded were done in 2, 3, 4, 5 sessions, so they worked quickly. George Martin is now back. Here he is in the control room at EMI with a cigarette in his hand. Everybody smoked at Beatles recording sessions. The colour of Beatles recording sessions was nicotine orange because everybody smoked. The man in the middle pulling on his cigarette, that's Jeff Emerick, who was the sound engineer capturing the sounds that the Beatles made. And here actually is kind of what they smoked. John was a Rothmans king-sized guy. Ringo liked his American ciggies, Lark. Paul went for the real heavy tar, no filter, working man cigarette, senior service. And Jeff Emerick smoked a brand of menthol cigarettes called Everest. So the Beatles are now working again at Abbey Road, but it very nearly wasn't the case, because though they recorded there for years and years and years, they very nearly recorded here instead. This is Hornsey Road in Holloway, in North London, just a few miles east of Abbey Road. And that building in red that I picked out there, this is a cinema that opened in 1911. This is that cinema, again from the London Metropolitan Archive, the plan, really weird building with a long way in and a long way out, and everyone seated in the rear. It opened as the Hornsey Palace, but like a lot of cinemas in this country, it had fallen into disuse by the 1950s and become a recording studio, Mercury Sound Recordings. And in my job as a historian writing this trilogy, I spend a lot of time in archives, and I look for things that I know I'm going to find, but I also look for things, or I look, go into archives with nothing in particular in mind, just to see what I might find. And I was going through the minutes of board meetings of EMI for the 1950s, and found to my great surprise that in 1956 it was decided by EMI that everything except classical music would be kicked out of Abbey Road. That was jazz, swing, vocal records, novelty records, and coming rock and roll records, would all be recorded at Hornsey Road. They were buying that old Mercury Sound Studios, and they were going to be recording everything except classical there. They authorised the expenditure of nearly £15,000 on equipment, and then they took out a 25-year lease on the building that would have taken it through to 1972. They repaired the leaky roof, they got it ready, and then, as so often happens with companies or corporations, someone just changed their mind and they decided to not use Hornsey Road. They had bought it, but they would get rid of it again and keep everything at Abbey Road instead. Well, only 5 years later, the Beatles came along and were signed by EMI. And because they were obliged for years to only use the house studio, they recorded at Abbey Road, but they would never have recorded there. They would have done all their recording at Hornsey Road had somebody not changed their mind. And I speculate that the last main Beatles album would not have been Abbey Road, but in a graphic that I've gone to great expense, it would have been this, Hornsey Road. And that is how slender the threads of life can be. That they would never have recorded at Abbey Road, but really not for one person changing their mind. And we know Abbey Road is the most famous recording studios in the world, but we would never have known it at all had it gone through as Hornsey Road. Nonetheless, they are at Abbey Road. And when they work there, they're not alone, because there are loads of Beatles fans outside the studio to greet the Beatles whenever they arrived and whenever they left. The Beatles have given up touring. They're no longer going out to the public, so the devoted fans are coming to see them instead. They know they're going to be there most afternoons, pretty much a routine, arrive at 2 o'clock and start work. And so the fans are outside. And the 13, 14, 15-year-old boys and girls of 1963-64 are now 18, 19, 20 years old. They've got jobs, they've got money, they've got cameras, they've got some of them colour film in their cameras. And they're outside waiting for the Beatles. And the Beatles, to their enormous credit, do not come and go through a discreet side entrance of the studio that they could have used, and they're still there to this day. They always came and went through the front, because they had a fantastic relationship with their public, right from the beginning to the end. They recognised that people were waiting for them and didn't want to disappoint them. They would often sign autographs, they would pose for these photographs, and these girls and boys would actually keep journals as well, which are incredibly useful for me. I've got pictures of them coming and going every day to write from, and also the girls and boys' journals of the period as well, and what kind of mood they were in and what they said and that kind of thing. So the Beatles fans are very devoted, and these colour pictures are theirs from the summer of 1969. When I said that Paul was living around the corner, that often meant he was the first to arrive at the studio, and sometimes he would work without the others because they hadn't arrived yet. And he had a short little piece that he wanted to record. It only needed him, so he went in and recorded him on the 2nd of July at the start of this new branch of sessions. Here is Her Majesty.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changed from day to day. I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. Her Majesty's a very nice girl, so they wanna make a mine. They wanna make a mine.
Short little 23-second piece by Paul McCartney. Her Majesty, I really like this because he fancies the Queen, and one day he'll marry her when he's ready. But first, he's going to drink a whole load of wine. So quite an unusual number. And the next number was another Paul McCartney song, and that was. Well, it belongs to this story. This photograph here, taken in July 1966, shows Paul McCartney with his father up at the house he bought for him on the Wirral, the other side of the River Mersey from Liverpool. This is Jim Mack, Jim McCartney. And Jim had a jazz band of his own in the 1920s, Jim Mack's Jazz Band, playing the same kind of halls around Liverpool where the Beatles would play 40 years later. And he was a great influence on Paul McCartney's musical education. Jim was widowed in 1956, that was when Paul was 14, that's when Paul lost his mother. But in 1964, Jim took a new wife, a much younger woman called Angela Williams, Angie. She was a widow herself with a young daughter called Ruth. So whenever Paul went home to see his dad, there would be a stepmother figure there, and also a young stepsister in Ruth. And she was learning the piano in 1969, and had opened up a music stand, an old folio with a lullaby in it called Golden Slumbers. And Paul, brilliant musician that he was and remains, couldn't read the dots. So he looked at Golden Slumbers, he liked the look of the words, but didn't know how it went, so he made up a new melody to go with it. Here is actually how it was in its original form.
Golden slumbers kiss your eyes, smiles await you when you rise. Sleep, pretty darling, do not cry. And I will sing a lullaby.
Notice at the bottom of the left-hand side there, he actually says sleep, pretty wanton, do not cry. I don't think you can all see that. And that's because this actually was a very old piece of work, the manuscript 1924, but actually it goes back to 1600, written by a playwright called Thomas Dekker, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare. Well, Paul wrote a new melody for this, different from the one we just heard, and the Beatles then recorded it, but only three of the Beatles, because John is detained in hospital, and when eventually he and Yoko do come out and fly back south, she's in a particularly groggy state from the crash, and John devotes himself to looking after her for until about the third week of July, and doesn't attend or doesn't actually participate in any of these sessions. So when Paul is on the piano, George plays what Paul would usually play, the bass guitar, and we'll see and hear that in a moment. Here is also the moment when the medley idea for the Abbey Road album takes place. That great idea for a kind of symphonic suite of songs all strung together, short pieces all strung together, which would grace the album, side two of the album when it was released. It takes root here. Really the idea of Paul McCartney and George Martin. Both Paul and John had a number of short pieces of work, kind of unfinished songs, and by bringing them together they were able to make very effective creative use of them. And often the way they recorded these was to butt them up together at the time of recording. So Golden Slumbers is recorded in combination with another McCartney song called Carry That Weight. So we'll hear both of those now. And you'll also notice how Paul references You Never Give Me Your Money. So he's already kind of stringing together the songs that we will hear together on the album. Here's Golden Slumbers and Carry That Weight.
Once there was a way to get back homeward, once there was a way to get back home. Sleepy darling, do not cry, and I will sing a lullaby. Send you
Before they go into record, they have meetings at Apple with stockbrokers and merchant bankers and lawyers and accountants and all sorts of heavy people discussing heavy business stuff. And George looked out of the window one morning when he woke up at Isha in his bungalow and looked and thought, oh, what a nice day. I really, really don't want to go into the office today and sit through all that boring stuff. I'm going to sag off. Liverpool terminology for playing truant is to sag off. So I'm not going to go in, I'm going to sag off, and I'm going to go and see my mate Eric instead. So instead of turning his car up the A3 to London, he takes it down the A3 to Eric's place, and it's a nice day, as I said, so they're walking in the garden, something like here, this is George and Eric in Eric's garden, and the song kind of just comes up in the moment. It's a, George has a feel-good feeling, and that is what he invests into the song, Here Comes the Sun. George and Eric were really close pals by this point. They've even got a record together on the charts. It's a bit NME chart for May 69, May 14. And there's a song at number 19 called Bouch. That is a Harrison Clapton composition. They're both playing on it as well, recorded by Eric's band, Cream. So this is where Here Comes the Sun takes root in Eric's garden. But I do wonder whether George knew of this. This is a 1945 film by two of the Crazy Gang, Flanagan and Allen. And I was interested to find this in the British Library. This is the May 69 issue of Vanity Fair, which as a model, his wife Patty would have had around the house. And there's an article on beachwear in there called Here Comes the Sun. So maybe George saw that. Well, anyway, he takes it into the studio. John is still missing, so it's still only three Beatles, but they record it. After this, it's going to be a 20-minute interval, and I'll see you again for part two. Yoko, who is poorly from the crash, and he's not that particularly strong himself. He does, however, make a flying visit to the studio. The Beatles are doing Maxwell's Silver Hammer the day that he gets there, and he doesn't stick around, John. Either he was just planning to drop in and just lend his moral support and say, see you when we're better, or he actually just didn't quite fancy what they were recording and quickly skedaddled. But the next song that they were recording is Maxwell's Silver Hammer, and here it is.
George Harrison, let's be gone.
John was quizzical, studied metaphysical science in the home.
One was Over the Dio, the Dar on the White Album, and this was the other one. And in 2008, Ringo said to Rolling Stone that the worst session ever was Maxwell's Silver Hammer. It was the worst track we ever had to record. It went on for weeks. And I thought it was mad. Paul said they got annoyed because it took 3 days to record. Big deal. And George said, sometimes Paul would make us do these really fruity songs by George Harrison. I mean, my God, Maxwell's Silver Hammer was so fruity. After a while, we did a good job on it, but when Paul got an idea or an arrangement in his head, dot, dot, dot. And John said in an interview to promote the Abbey Road album, it's a typical McCartney sing-along, or whatever you call them. He did quite a lot of work on it. I was ill after the accident when they did most of that track, and I believe that he really ground George and Ringo into the ground. That is an interview to promote the album. Well, the song itself included the word pataphysical, and that was the word that Paul first heard in January 1966. He was driving north to see his dad, driving up the M1, and heard a play on the third programme, the forerunner of Radio 3, by the French playwright Alfred Jarry, that included the word pataphysics. It was essentially the description of a philosophy beyond metaphysics. That's about all I can tell you on that one. Quite a jolly pop song, Maxwell's Silver Hammer, which it had three murders in it. Well, John had come and then gone from that session, but on the 21st of July, he finally did return to the Beatles, having missed 3 weeks of sessions. Man had landed on the moon in the middle of that night, and then a few hours later, John returned to Abbey Road, and he had his new song that he wanted them to record called Come Together.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Slowly, got to be a
track come together, came together in the recording studio, that kind of that swampy arrangement kind of was cooked up between the Beatles right there in the session. As a song, it came together when the man at the bottom here, Timothy Leary, asked John Lennon to write him a campaign song. He was planning to run against the governor of California, Ronald Reagan, who was seeking re-election in late 1969. Leary was going to try and become the governor instead. In fact, when the election took place, he was in jail for possession of marijuana and wasn't able to stand. Leary was the author of The Psychedelic Experience, the manual based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. This was every acid age dream. Leary was the great guru of the drug LSD. John had read that book, and by 1969, John and Yoko were friends with Leary and Leary's wife, Rosemary. Here they are as Montreal bedding the piece that we saw earlier. In fact, both the Learys are singing on Give Peace a Chance. And Leary mentioned to John that he was planning to run for governor of California, and here was his campaign poster, which ends at the bottom there as his slogan, "Come together, join the party." And he hoped that John would write him a song that included the words "come together." And John did. He started writing the song, but in the end, he so enjoyed what he was doing that he thought he would just keep it for a Beatles record and wouldn't give it to Leary. And then in the end, Leary didn't actually run anyway because he was in prison. So that's how Come Together came to be written. When he was writing it, John took some lines or a few words from an old Chuck Berry song. Here is what Chuck originally sang. That's what Chuck wrote in 1956, and here's what John Lennon wrote in 1969.
Here come old flat up, he come grooving up slowly. He got juju eyeball, he want early roller, he got hair.
And that borrowing of one line, or maybe two if you depending on how you divide it, landed John with a plagiarism lawsuit. John Lennon and Paul McCartney were amongst the most ripped off composers of the 60s and for decades afterwards as well, because their ideas were so novel that they were used by lots of people. But whenever they took anything from anybody else's song, they would run the risk of something like this. It was business, so that's all it was really. The publishers of John Lennon's You Can't Catch Me eventually forced John to record three of their other songs from their songwriting catalogue. And John had to record an album called Rock and Roll in the 1970s, really because of that reason. John and Chuck Berry themselves were okay. Here's a picture of them together in 1972 on American TV. They were fine. It was just a business thing. Well, for the previous couple of weeks after they got out of hospital, John had been looking after Yoko. She still wasn't very well, but instead of looking after her in bed at home, John looked up after her in bed in the recording studio. So a bed was brought into EMI number 3 studio, delivered by Harrods, and she rested at the session. Here she is on the bed with Linda McCartney, quite heavily pregnant by this time. The woman on the far left, that's Patsy Harrison. And the man with the beard, that's the Beatles' other great aide through the 1960s, their roadie, Mal Evans. And it's quite likely, I think, that Yoko took the pictures of the Beatles' recording Come Together that we saw when it was being heard, because of these two pictures, which are a bit of a giveaway, where she didn't quite get her shoes out of the way in time. Now, in the left-hand picture, if you see that, the left edge of the left-hand picture has a wooden cabinet, like a piece of wooden furniture. That is actually a Leslie loudspeaker, a Leslie speaker. Inside of that cabinet was a revolving loudspeaker. And the Beatles found that if you input sounds through that and then recorded the output, that it would actually have a different effect. And they liked to have the Leslie speaker around them when they were recording. George in particular put his guitar through it. And during the course of this session, he had his McVitie's digestive biscuits on top of the Leslie speaker cabinet. And this, we know, became the cause of one of the great arguments that the Beatles had in their years together. They didn't actually argue very much, the Beatles. Most other bands would argue far, far more, or even hate one another. The Beatles were great mates. But they did argue on this occasion. They're in the number 3 control room at EMI, listening to a playback of Come Together, and George sees through the glass Yoko tiptoe out of her bed, go over to his Leslie speaker cabinet and take one of his digestive biscuits, and he went absolutely bonkers. And he and John had a huge argument about it. Now, whether it was a chocolate biscuit or a plain digestive, I'm really not sure. It's probably not that relevant. The point is, George was really upset about it, and it wasn't really about the biscuit. It was about the fact that Yoko was in bed at their session. Now, they'd got used to her being at every session for over a year now, but that was, you know, when she sat on the floor or on a chair. But to actually be in bed at their session was something that they really did struggle with for the few days that she did it. So I was amused to find this. This is a Suffolk area newsletter for the Beatles fan club. And on the third page of this September 69 bulletin, news bits and pieces, bed in which Yoko recorded at EMI has now only three legs. One was stolen when fans smuggled their way in. Well, I reckon the fan who sawed off one of her legs was probably a bearded lead guitarist from Liverpool, still smarting over the theft of one of his digestive biscuits. And it also made me think about this. This is Paul and Linda McCartney's album Ram from 1971, with a track on it called Three Legs. Is that also a biscuit reference, I asked myself? Don't you see Paul McCartney asking that question? Well, now that John is back, they record it, comes together, there's a bit of a glut of Lennon songs because he hasn't been there for a while. The next Lennon song I'm going to play you, first I'll show you, play you a musical clue. Here is what inspired it. Sounds of 1969. Fleetwood Mac, then led by the man in the middle here, Peter Green, who composed that tune. And he's wearing, if you can just about make it out, a badge that says Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. So he's showing his influence there. The Beatles had influenced him. But it was a two-way street, because John was a particular fan of Fleetwood Mac. I think they had already informed the way that he wrote I Want You. And now he took the Albatross sound and wove it into a song that he had written, which had the working title Here Comes the Sun King, but was ultimately released as simply Sun King. Recorded for the medley, butted up to a second piece called Me, Mr. Mustard, I'll play that now and tell you the story of that one after we've heard it.
Me and Mr. Mustard sleeps in the park, shapes in the dark, trying to save paper. Sleeps in a hole in the road, saving up to buy some clothes. Keeps a 10-mile note up his nose. Such a mean old man. His sister Pam works in the shop. She never stops. She's a go-getter. Takes him out to look at the queen. Only place that he's ever been. Always shouts out something obscene. Such a dirty old man.
May have noticed amongst the pieces I showed you there was a piece about 4,000 holes in the road in Blackburn, Lancashire. That was in the Daily Mail in January 1967, and John saw that and took that bit of information and fed it into the song A Day in the Life for the Sgt. Pepper album. And he liked to draw upon newspapers, things that he read. He was a great reader of newspapers. And I was interested to find an obscure interview with John a few months ago, found it a few months ago, in which he said that Me, Mr. Mustard actually came from a newspaper piece as well. And as a historian, I'm thinking, well, which newspaper piece was that? Where did he see it published and so on? What's the story here? So I went looking for it and eventually did find it. And then, me being me, I just kind of kept on going. And in the end, I kind of strung together the life story of the man who was Mr. Mustard. After all, he inspired a song that has sold something like 35 million copies so far, and I wondered who he was. So I put together the information that I found into a little presentation which I called The Parsimonious Life of a Civil Servant. Alexander Mustard, and he was born in Elgin in Scotland, North East Scotland, in 1902. Here is Elgin in North East Scotland, and here is the house he was born. It's still there. I think it should have a blue plaque on it. Me, Mr. Mustard, born here, South Gildrey Street, that is, in Elgin. And amazingly, the Beatles played in Elgin about half a mile from his house. They played here at the Red Shoes Theatre in January 1963, when they were the Love Me Do Boys, the Beatles, playing just down the road from Mustard. Well, Mustard married three times. His first wife died, and his second wife lived with him when he was a civil servant, and he worked for the National Assistance Board. That's the forerunner of the DHSS. Quite ironic, really, when you consider that he didn't really want to ever give any money away, and there he was working for the National Assistance Board. As you can see from the bottom, men were paid more than women in those days, and nothing has changed in that respect. He and his wife Frieda lived in Old Park View in Enfield in North London, in this little bungalow here. And here it was that Mustard shaved in the dark, because he was too mean to switch the light on, because he didn't want to pay the electricity bill. And in fact, he was so mean, according to these divorce court reports in the newspaper, he was so mean that he made his wife Frieda listen to the radio in the dark, because there was nothing to look at, and therefore, why switch the light on? And he also recorded the room temperatures, room by room, in his diary, and she had to ensure that the temperatures did not rise above what I'm sure was a very cold level. And this all came out when she sued him for divorce. She really couldn't take his meanness anymore. In the final year of their marriage, he gave her £1 in housekeeping, and she had to account for every penny. Well, it made the Daily Mail, it made the Daily Mirror, and it also made the newspapers in Enfield in North London. And I was intrigued to find that it went out on the wire services. Here it is in the Spanish newspaper, El Correo, Caleo, Maxima Tacañería, meaning maximum stinginess. In Spanish. Well, I've tried everywhere I could to find a photograph of Mustard, but I've been unable to this point. I'm still looking, but I have found his death certificate. He died in 1984. He was alive for nearly 15 years after the Abbey Road album came out. I have no idea whether he knew that he was the inspiration of that song. I've got his will with his signature on it. You can actually see it arriving in this document there. He left about £11,000 in his will. And I said he married three times, even after that well-publicised divorce. Another woman did marry him, a woman called Marjorie, and she was the beneficiary of all of his estate. He left everything to my dear wife Marjorie, which could be a lovely term of endearment, or may just be a reflection on how much money she had. The other strange thing about this is that John Lennon wrote this song in India in March, April 1968. That is John Lennon there in that photograph, sitting on the roof of the Beatles' ashram bungalow when they were out studying meditation under the Maharishi via the River Ganges. And I was surprised, therefore, to find that the newspaper piece that inspired the song was written, well, published 9-10 months earlier. There it is, the Daily Mail, Daily Mirror, June 1967. So how come John Lennon retained this in his head for 9-10 months? And then I started to think, well, maybe, and it is just maybe, there was something that the value that he wanted to transport out to India, and for safekeeping, he wrapped up a newspaper just to ensure that it didn't break. And he eventually gets to Rishikesh, takes out his item, unfolds the newspaper, flattens it out, and there is the Mustard article, and that is how I think he probably came to write it there. So that's the backstory of me and Mr. Mustard. That goes into the medley, along with the next two tracks, Polythene Pan, and She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. This is the only instance of a John Lennon song and a Paul McCartney song being recorded together, kind of as one piece. And I'll tell you the stories of those after we've heard them, but the reason why I've got some old Liverpool pictures of the Beatles with the Polythene Pan is because there is a connection to the song. And listen out for John singing it in a particularly broad Scouse accent.
Okay?
Yeah.
A 1, 2, 3, 4.
When you see Polythene Pan, she's so good looking, but she looks like a man. Well, you should see her in a flat dress in a holiday bag. Yes, you should see a holiday bag. Yeah, yeah,
this picture of Paul and George and John at the back of Paul McCartney's council house in Liverpool, which is now a National Trust property. So this is how the idea of Polythene Pan, or Pat as a title, came into John's head. But the story actually has a second influence as well, and that is because of this man here, Royston Ellis. He was our beat poet. He was our answer to Allen Ginsberg at the end of the 1950s. And he liked to read his beat poetry backed by beat musicians. In fact, he was backed by the Beatles in a coffee bar in Liverpool in 1960 and managed to get their name into a music paper for the first time as a result. The very bottom line there, Beatles, misspelled with a double E. But that was in Record Mirror in July 1960. There are no photographs of the Beatles backing him, but he was also backed by the Shadows. Here he is with them. And he liked to also read his poetry backed by a young, unknown lead guitarist called Jimmy Page. So he had a lot of good people working with him. Eventually, he re-meets the Beatles in August 1963 in Guernsey. Royston was working the summer season in Guernsey on boats. The Beatles turned up to play a one-nighter in Guernsey, and they met, and here they are backstage in 1963. And that very week, Royston had published a new little folio of his poetry called A Seaman's Suitcase. And if you look at the lines in the middle, it was dedicated by him to Tony and Jet, that's Tony Meehan and Jet Harris of the Shadows, to Christine Keeler, contemporary 63, and the Beatles in admiration of their achievements. It was actually the first ever publication dedicated to the Beatles, and he gave them copies of it, and they were enjoying reading his poetry aloud, and they particularly enjoyed this one here, where he wrote, "I long to have sex between black leather sheets and ride shivering motorcycles through your thighs. I long to have sex on the sand in the sun and smear myself with suntan oil on your body." Pretty racy stuff, especially for 1963. And it gave John and Royston an idea. At the end of the evening, when the Beatles had finished, they went out on the town, and Royston phoned up an obliging young woman he knew who would do a threesome for them that night, and wore plastic or polythene or PVC of some kind in bed. I asked Royston for more details, but he really couldn't remember. I think that kind of thing probably happened to him quite a lot. So when John wrote Polythene Pan, he had both Polythene Pan in his head and also this incident on Guernsey in 1963, and that's what the song is all about. As for She Came In Through the Bathroom Window, well, here is Paul McCartney's house in St. John's Wood in London, a period picture, as you can see from the cars. And he had a housekeeper who would go out shopping or run errands or whatever, and the fans outside would know when she was out. And of course they would know when Paul was out at the recording studio, and then they would jump over the wall and break in, sometimes entering the house through the bathroom window. And on one occasion when a fan broke in, she actually took these photographs. So these are photographs taken by a burglar inside Paul McCartney's house in 1968. And here we see how a very wealthy and successful young man lived in 1968 in London. Nothing like a plush place would look these days, 50 odd years on. He did, however, have a new colour television. And then if you look at the top right, top left picture, he's got the original artwork for the Sgt. Pepper album up on the wall. But in this photograph here, I feel Paul is pretty much saying to these girls, "I've locked it now, and you're never going to get it in again." Well, those tracks were written for the medley, and now they string the medley together for the first time. It's July the 30th, 1969, and here is the tape box where they're running it all together, from You Never Give Me Your Money, through Sun King, Me, Mr. Mustard, Her Majesty, Polythene Pan, Bathroom Window, Golden Slumbers, Carry That Weight, and Ending. Ending is what became The End. It's the only track I haven't played you, but it's coming. The Beatles always had very strong instinctive ideas, and this, as an initial run-through, worked completely, but for one thing. Her Majesty, coming between Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pan, kind of dragged the pace somewhat. And it turned, Mustard is electric and Polythene Pan is electric, and Her Majesty being acoustic just didn't fit there. So they edited it out of the tape, crossed it off the box there. And if you can see, it says CCIR, and then it says Her Majesty after End. The engineers at Abbey Road were well trained. They were told never to throw anything away. So basically the engineer ran a load of blank tape, or leader as it was called, after the end of the final track Ending, and then put Her Majesty there for safekeeping, and that's exactly where it would remain. Well, the medley is now pretty much in place, just needs a little bit of finesse, but it is otherwise there. And the last new song to be recorded for the album was John Lennon's track Because. And here is his handwritten lyric for it: "Because the world is round, it turns me on." And as a reminder of the constant factor in their lives throughout the year. It's on the back of a business letter from Eastman & Eastman to the Four Beatles, carping on about how Alan Klein's performance was so poor and they could have done much better if only the Beatles had trusted them. This kind of thing was just happening all the time. John flips over the piece of paper and writes "because" on the back. I'm going to play you "Because" now. It's a song of exquisite three-part vocal harmonies by John, Paul and George. There are no photographs of them recording it, so I've shown you some other pictures of them doing that same kind of singing, which they've been doing right from the beginning. We saw that colour picture of them in 1958. They'd always loved singing together. Ringo isn't singing on it, and he's not heard on the track, but actually he was tapping his thigh to keep the beat for them as they sang. And at the end of it, you will hear the Moog synthesizer. George Harrison has brought in his Moog from his bungalow and is now installed at Abbey Road, and it's going to be part of the Beatles recording sessions to finish off the album from this point on. So here is "Because". Listen out for a note dying away by accident at the end of a line. It wasn't meant to happen that way, but the Beatles always took advantage of things like that. Things that weren't meant to happen but did happen, and they went, "Oh, let's keep that." So listen out for that. Here is the mode on "Here Comes the Sun". Having reached the point where they now merely songs that they've recorded, they're not actually going to be adding any more new tracks. There comes that point where they thought to themselves, what are we going to call this record that we're making? There is always that time when you're creating something where you have to wonder what the title is going to be. And they don't actually have a title for this album at this point. And they see Jeff Emmerich's pack of Everest menthol cigarettes and think to themselves, we could call our album Everest. And there was a brief period of time when they were actually going to call this album Everest, or maybe Everest, they were playing with it. And they particularly liked the little graphic on the pack of the cigarettes there of the mountain, Mount Everest. So they entertained the idea of going to Tibet, having their picture taken with Mount Everest in the background. And then I think they probably thought, oh no, why are we going to go to such bother? Why don't we just make it much more simple? The Beatles had recorded a song called Penny Lane, named after a street in Liverpool, hugely successful record. And I think Paul McCartney stepped forward at this point and said, why don't we name this album after this street, the one we've been working on all these years, since 1962, why don't we call it Abbey Road? And he sketched this. This is Paul McCartney's work. The main drawing here is Paul McCartney's work. The idea for what the cover could be, taking advantage of the road, and the zebra crossing with the four of them there walking across it. And then they approached Ian McMillan, who was a particular photographer for John Yoko. He was a friend of Yoko's from 1966, did a lot of work with her. He sketched the one in the top right corner that was much more how he wished it to be, how he envisaged it, taking advantage of the symmetry of the trees and the sky and the zebra crossing in the foreground. But he needed to know whether it would work. So 2 days before the Beatles were due to go out and have their picture taken there, he went out with four other guys and took this photo. If we number the guys 1, 2, 3, 4 from the left, number one was Kevin Harrington. He was at every Beatles recording session, he was the assistant to Al Evans, moving the amplifiers around and fetching and carrying with the Beatles. The second left is a man who worked at the studio only for that summer. No one who was there then is alive still that I've asked remembers his name, so we just don't know who he was. The man third left was called Steve Brendel. He got a job with the Beatles on the Monday, and doing this on the Wednesday, must have just thought he did the perfect job. And the man on the right, the older guy, was John Skinner. He was the commissioner of the studios. He would stand outside in his kind of serge, worsted tunic and salute as he went in. And McMillan, the photographer, learned two things from this shoot. One was that someone had parked a white Volkswagen car there and gone off on holiday, and that was going to be in the way when he was taking pictures of the Beatles 2 days later. And the other one was that he needed to have greater elevation. So 2 days later, when he was with the Beatles, he brought along a step ladder and climbed that just to be able to have a better height. And then 2 days later, the 8th of August 1969, the Beatles gathered on the steps of EMI to have the pictures taken. They were clever. They knew that the fans would begin arriving after lunch, expecting them always to arrive for work around 2 o'clock, the Beatles. So they did this in the morning and could therefore work fairly uninterrupted. And they're sitting there waiting for McMillan to be ready to call them to the side of the road. And then eventually he does, and they step out. Paul McCartney wearing sandals at this point. They take the first picture walking across the crossing. This says one of six, and you know, only six pictures were taken. You would take 100 today in the hope of getting a good one. They only took six and hoped for the best, and they turned out to be lucky. So they get to the far side, where another old woman comes on in her house, the cousin of those two other women, I'm sure. But you can see the easy interaction the Beatles have with their public. You know, you can't get near a star these days. They're so cosseted and protected and secured, and you can understand why to an extent. But the Beatles, people could always get right up to them, and that's why they have this great interaction with their public, because they're having an easy conversation with her while they're waiting for McMillan to be ready. Eventually they are, walk back across the road, and Paul's still in his sandals. But when they get to the far side, he picks them off and leaves them against the wall. And the next four pictures, he'll be barefoot. And they take pictures number 3 and 4, and then 5 and 6. And that is the end of the shoot. They end it with 6 pictures. 5 of them are okay, not really very good, not usable. But one of them is absolutely perfect. And here it is, shot number 5. And there they have it, the cover of the album. That is how simple the Beatles could create a piece of enduring art. just as quick and as easy as that. Macmillan then went further up the road. He was particularly taken with these tiled street signs that are a feature of that area of northwest London, and he found the one that he took on the corner of Alexandra Road. That's now demolished. There's a block of flats there now. And was initially irritated when a girl in a blue dress walked by and got in the way of the picture, but that ended up being the one that they used. And here is Mal Evans' diary entry from that day, the 8th of August 1969, noting how Ringo was the first to arrive and how police held up the traffic while Macmillan took the pictures. And then George Ferrari and I, and that's George Harrison, his Ferrari car, went to Regent's Park Zoo and meditated in the sun, and then to the Krishna Temple for lunch, so the Krishnas have got their temple pretty quickly. John and Yoko went to Paul and Linda, John, Yoko and Ringo went to Paul and Linda's for lunch. It was very nice. This is how people used to write diaries. Well, the only track I haven't played you so far for the album that now has a title and a cover is the one that they called The End, although when they recorded it, it was simply Ending. I'm just going to play you the beginning of that, and then I'll talk to you some more afterwards. Called Ending or The End, they actually had a considered view. What is it that we've never done in the recording studio that we can now do? And one of them was that Ringo had never done a drum solo. So Ringo advised them with a drum solo. John, Paul and George all played lead guitar. George was the lead guitarist, but they could all play it, but they'd never had a track where more than one of them played it at the same time, or in sequence. And they hit upon the idea of having a section of The End, where first Paul and then George and then John would each play lead guitar in turn. Now, there are no photographs of them recording this, but I've put together some other pictures that will give you a sense of what it would have looked like. Well, the last bit of vocal recording for the Abbey Road album was John and Paul adding a new section on the end of John Lennon's song I Want You to make it I Want You, She's So Heavy. And they've been singing together since they met in 1957, and here actually was the last time.
She's so heavy!
Business and so on outside the recording studio. Once inside, the Beatles are always capable of making great music together. And it was great for them to have George Martin back. And he always had been someone who could give them whatever they wanted. And in particular, he was an orchestrator. He had been trained at music school to orchestrate and could conduct the musicians when they came in to record. So there were five tracks on the Abbey Road album that George Martin wrote scores for which he was paid the grand sum of £30 each for the lifetime of world copyright. Which was not very much money, but actually it was £5 better than anybody else got. That was George Martin's preferential rate, because the going rate at that point was 25 quid per song. But George Martin happily accepted that because he knew what the conditions were, and he gave the Beatles always exactly what it was they were looking for. And when they did the orchestration on Something, George Harrison, this is, went off to the side of the studio and recorded an overdub, as an overdub, his lead guitar solo for that track, Something. So here is what George Martin and then George Harrison did. Now, those who follow the Beatles and know something of them have always thrilled to the fact that the Beatles had the incredible, brilliant sense to end the final album that they ever made with a track called The End. I mean, how fantastic is that? But actually, this is as an alternative idea is equally as strong, because had it ended with I Want You instead of The End, then the Beatles' last album would have ended like this. Idea that would have been equally as strong. And this is what you need to know about the Beatles, is that when they didn't only have one brilliant idea, they actually had two, and either one of them would have worked perfectly well. Because if the last Beatles album had ended on a slash note like that, what a fantastic way to go out that would have been. However, when it was The End that they went with, but it wasn't actually the last track, because there was still Her Majesty, and the Beatles had got used to hearing Her Majesty after all the other tracks on that tape, with a long period of silence before it, where the engineer had put some blank tape in, and they had it transferred to the master tape in exactly the same position. And the idea of this was that it would be like a surprise, and if in those days you were playing a record and you didn't manually lift off the stylus at the end of what you thought was the last track, there would be a long period of silence, and then suddenly there's going to be another track that you weren't expecting. And that was deliberate by the Beatles. They wanted it to be just this surprise item. And I was pleased to find this document in the archive of the EMI in Denmark, making it clear that the Beatles had said that Her Majesty was to be added simply as a playoff sound and need not be treated as another work on the album. And this explains to me why it never appears in the track listing. Her Majesty, I think it's on the centre label, but that's a copyright thing. But in the listing on the album cover, it ends with the end, and there's no mention of Her Majesty. Just there as a surprise, if you haven't lifted off the stylus at the end of the record. Well, with this, the Abbey Road album was finally complete, and it came out on September 26, 1969, 50 years ago, plus a couple of weeks. And was an instant number one. It was number one for 18 straight weeks in the UK alone, and went on to become the Beatles' biggest selling album of them all, eclipsing even Sgt. Pepper. And of course it was reviewed, but, if this may surprise you, it's reviewed very badly. Here's the Daily Mirror. Sorry, but there's only a rare glimpse of the magic of the Beatles in their new album, Abbey Road, saved by two superb George Harrison tracks and Ringo's Octopus and Garden. Shame if we ever come to ask what happened to Lennon and McCartney. How about this in Rolling Stone? Side 2 is a disaster. And it ends, surely they must have enough talent and intelligence to do better than this, or do they? Tune in next time and find out. And here is the New York Times with a review by the British rock writer Nick Cohn. He liked the medley. He said that the medley was the most impressive music the Beatles have made since Rubber Soul. But he really didn't like much else. If you look in the middle column there, he says, the six tracks on the first side and the opening two tracks on the flip are all write-offs. And he says, the two songs by George Harrison are mediocrity incarnate. And in the final column at the bottom, he says, the Beatles have got upwards of 60 tracks in a year. And my goodness, that is true, 60 tracks in a year. But at least two-thirds of those have been dead wood. So he would have, Nick Cohn would have actually cut about 40 tracks from the Beatles' last couple of albums. I prefer this review that ran in America in Saturday Review by Ellen Sander. This Beatles album, Abbey Road, is pure beauty, a wonderful album. And then she wrote, and I think this comment is particularly true of today as it was 50 years ago, some folk poet once said that in ugly times, beauty is the only true protest, and if nothing else, Abbey Road bears him out. So those are some of the reviews of the album. Now let's have a quick look at the impact of the album on the place where it was made. As I said earlier, it was called EMI Recording Studios, and that's what the Beatles always called it, EMI. But by 1976, it's been renamed Abbey Road Studios. Everyone is now calling it Abbey Road, so the management bowed to the inevitable and changed the name of the building to match the album title, Abbey Road Studios. And if you look in the top right, always found it hard to resist the zebra crossing as part of the logo. The impact of the album on the city of Westminster was they had to bolt down all their street signs because quite a lot of them were stolen. They've been coming up through Sotheby's and Christie's in recent years, so they had to bolt them down. This, remember, is the other side of the cover with the Tyler street sign. I went up Abbey Road in May of this year taking pictures. There is only one of these left now. This is my photograph from May. Thankfully, it's free of graffiti. Thankfully, it's still there at all and hasn't been stolen. And I really like that. I find it very beautiful, and I hope it stays that way. The white Volkswagen car that was parked there, it would of course be a Beetle, wouldn't it? That is now in a museum in Germany. And the zebra crossing, well, that is now one of London's busiest tourist sites. I say now, it has been for 50 years. Again, back in May of this year, I went down Abbey Road with my camera. I sat quietly on a wall and just filmed a few seconds of what continually goes on that zebra crossing. This is a busy road in London, and it's amazing there's never been a fatality there. I'm about to show you now the scene on August the 8th this year when the 50th anniversary of the Beatles photograph was celebrated. There it is. Imagine being on one of those buses. That took about an hour a couple of months ago now, August the 8th. This is a protected zebra crossing. It's actually listed and you can't do anything to it. Unlike this zebra crossing on Hornsey Road, unloved and deserted zebra crossing you never saw, even the white stripes are beginning to fade away. The recording studio where the Beatles would have recorded is just up there on the right hand side, now demolished and is a flats in its place. But had the Beatles actually recorded on the road and taken this picture, then the situation would have been so very different. Well, Abbey Road is probably the most parodied album cover of all time. I could actually show you more than 100 of these, but just whittled it down to a few. I like this one by Kanye West, late orchestration. I don't know whether that's Kanye actually inside the costume. Here's the best of Benny Hill. And here's the Red Hot Chili Peppers with their particularly long socks. And I like this one. This is an avant-garde jazz album from Soweto, the township in Johannesburg, South Africa. Armitage Road, look at that great homage on the cover there. Hinge and Bracket went one further than anybody else and had Ian McMillan come back and get out the stepladder again, as did Paul McCartney for a live album that he released a few years ago. Here's Doctor Who and the Daleks on the cover and the Crossing recently, and for some reason it's an endless appeal to conservative politicians. Here's Margaret Thatcher on the Zebra Crossing in 1989. And in more recent times, David Cameron. David Cameron crossing there with Tessa Jowell. And I like this this picture. This is five First Nationers from Alberta in Canada in their full headdress. And the Choristers of Canterbury. Well, the Beatles have had their picture taken on the crossing, but that was for an album cover. They still needed publicity pictures. And on August the 22nd, with the album completed, they went out to John Lennon's new house at Ascot in Berkshire and had a photo session. Linda took a little bit of film of that session, as we're about to see. There's much more of this on YouTube. I didn't want to include much of it here because it's her copyright, but if you go on YouTube, you'll see more of this. And there they are, the Abbey Road album is completed but not yet released. These are the four guys who have made it. Now the history books will tell you that the Beatles knew this was going to be their last album. They'd been on the verge of breaking up for a while and they were determined to make a strong final album, and that's why Abbey Road is so lush and melodic and full of great harmonies and musical invention. But in fact that isn't the case, and I know that because of this incident. Ringo was taken ill and rushed to hospital in September 1969. I mentioned earlier that he had a very tricky childhood, nearly died a couple of times. So when he had some intestinal problems in September 69, for safekeeping, just as a precaution, he went into hospital. And if you look at this piece, which was in the Melody Maker that week, on the front page of Melody Maker, third paragraph, Ringo was due to attend a big meeting at Apple's London headquarters on Tuesday, when the Beatles were discussing their plans for the future. Well, that Tuesday was the 9th of September 1969, and they were going to be discussing what they would do after Abbey Road. But because Ringo couldn't be there, John used his Philips cassette recorder, the one I've got over there on the table, to record the meeting so that Ringo could hear what it was he was missing. You can actually see in the picture on the right that John always had this cassette recorder to hand, so he sits it on the table, in a meeting at the Beatles Apple Company, in the Beatles room at Apple, and records the meeting. And here is what it would have looked like. Extract Ringo from this picture. This was taken at John's house in late August. But imagine Ringo's not in it, they're sitting around talking, and they have this discussion. Now, there was a big piece in the Guardian newspaper about 4 weeks ago about me and about this tour, which majored on the existence of this tape and how I would be playing the extracts from it. And it caught the attention of the Beatles Apple Company, and it was made very clear to me that I really, really should not be playing it. But there is one section that I can play and will be playing. You will hear a little bit of this tape, which I'm going to play for you shortly. And I can play you that because it's been quoted in a book a long time ago and is therefore already in the public domain. But I'm afraid that I've been prevented from playing you other bits of the tape that I had planned to do, but I can paraphrase them for you. Well, the meeting begins with John. John is running this meeting. He's been the leader from the start, and he's still the leader. And he's essentially called this meeting. And the first thing he says is, after they've wished Ringo better, is that from now on, Beatles albums have to be done on a pure democratic basis. The idea that John and Paul have always had a carved George out of it can no longer be maintained, because he is writing as many songs as they are and deserves to have an equal position. I mean, even on the Abbey Road album, There's one song by Ringo, there's two songs by George, and there's 14 Lennon McCartney numbers. So John is basically saying that from now on, Beatles albums, if they got 14 tracks, which was what they usually thought an album would have, Abbey Road had 17, but some of them are so short. So if an album is 14 tracks, it'll be four of mine, says John, four of yours, Paul, and four of George's. And if Ringo wants a couple of songs now that he's songwriting too, he can have those. So that's how we'll divide it up. George is now an absolute equal member of the Beatles. And he says to Paul, I want to talk about the Lennon and McCartney myth. And he actually uses that phrase. And what he means by that was that this idea of everybody thinking that they wrote everything together all the time is now beginning to really kind of get on their nerves, because people think they're Rodgers and Hammerstein, but they're not. Many of these songs are just written by John, many of them are written by Paul, but it looks like they've done everything together. The credit for Give Peace a Chance, which was entirely John's, was Lennon and McCartney. And the credit for Maxwell's Silver Hammer, which was entirely Paul's, was Lennon and McCartney. And I don't think John was particularly enamored with that idea. So he's saying to Paul, from now on, my songs should just be Lennon, and your songs can be McCartney, and his songs can be Harrison, and Ringo's songs can be Starkey. We don't need to do this joint credit business anymore. Then they talk about doing a single for Christmas. Now, whenever the Beatles recorded a single of Without Christmas, they had the number one position. There was no betting on what the number one would be like we have these days. If the Beatles had a record out, that was it, they were number one. And they talk about doing a single for Christmas 1969. And John has a song up his sleeve ready to go, which is called Cold Turkey. Which you think might make quite a good Christmas single, but in fact really wasn't about the meat on the table. It was about having had some kind of a problem with heroin in 1969. Not too much, I don't think, because his productivity that year, his lucidity was so extraordinary that he can't have been strung out very much. But nonetheless, he wrote Cold Turkey to sing about the experiences of withdrawing from heroin. And he wants to put that up as the next Beatles single out for Christmas. And it doesn't particularly gain what we would now call traction. So I think Ringo is okay with it, well, we know that because in the end when it's recorded he plays on it. But either George or Paul, or maybe both of them, aren't that keen. Anyway, that's the talk. They're going to do a single for Christmas. And then Paul pipes up and says that in his opinion, none of the songs George has written until this album have been good enough. By which he's talking about Taxman and Why My Guitar Gently Weeps and Within You Without You. In his opinion, they weren't very good. He likes something and he likes Here Comes the Sun, but he hadn't really rated any of the previous ones. And it's a measure of George's patience and tolerance that he doesn't get up and punch Paul on the nose when he says that. He actually just says, well, that's just your opinion. You know, plenty of people have liked my songs, and their opinion is as valid as yours. That's just your opinion. But it's amazing how they can actually have these conversations so evenly without anyone actually shouting or losing their temper. And that's one of the big takeaways from this tape. Well, there is a bit, as I said, that I can play you. I'm about to play it now. And the prelude to it is that a couple of days before this meeting, during a casual conversation, Paul has revealed to John, just mentioned in passing, that he didn't particularly rate or like Maxwell's Silver Hammer very much either. Or indeed, Obla Di Obla Da, the White Album, which was another of the songs that the other three Beatles had felt that Paul had somewhat ground them through. And John's been turning this over in his head, kind of ruminating on it, thinking, hang on a minute, we didn't enjoy those songs. And now it turns out that he didn't really enjoy them either. So that's the point where I can play you a little bit of the tape, and here is what John says. Oh, I should have been flipping through these pictures, but here we go.
Wouldn't it be better? Because we didn't really dig them. Mm-hmm. You know, for you to do songs that you dug and put over to your Maxwell to be given to people who like music like that, like Mary or whoever it is that needs a song. Why didn't you give them to them? The only time we need anything of any of that quality is for a single. And for an album, we could just do only stuff that you really dug. It's even mad for us to put our song on the album that nobody dug, including the guy who wrote it, just because it was going to be popular. Because the LP doesn't have to be popular that way.
you can hear the kind of the tone in the room. No one's raising their voice or shouting. They're just talking about what they're going to be doing from now on, the way they're going to go about it. The modern word for this is essentially roadmap. John is setting down the roadmap for how the Beatles can go forward from the Abbey Road album. But he very quickly finds that, having discussed with them that they should all bring their strongest tracks to the studio and all play on them to the best of their ability, when he puts forward Cold Turkey, one or two of them just don't want to know. And so he decides to record it with Plastic Ono Band instead. Ringo is on drums, so he's probably okay with it. Eric Clapton is on lead guitar in place of George Harrison. And Klaus Voormann, the Beatles' old Hamburg friend, is on bass in place of Paul McCartney. And here is what the next Beatles single could have been, but instead it's Plastic Ono Band. Side on the record label where it says Cold Turkey, the title of the song, underneath it in brackets, the composer credit, just John Lennon. The Lennon-McCartney credit is now finished with. They may possibly have been planning to come back to it, but there's no reason to put Paul McCartney's name on it, and so it just says John Lennon. This was recorded about the 8th of September 1960, what was it, about the 10th of September 1969, and on the 13th, John accepts an invitation, or has accepted an invitation, to go over to Toronto to play in a rock and roll festival, a big open air rock and roll festival there. Takes the Plastic Ono Band. That's Yoko, Eric Clapton, Klaus Voormann, and on drums, Alan White. And he so enjoys the experience that on the plane he's thinking, I don't need the Beatles anymore. You know, we had this plan for how we could go forward, and it's already kind of falling apart. And I could just be with the Plastic Ono Band. I don't need to have the other guys around me. And at this meeting here at Apple on about the 20th of September, with Ringo back out of hospital, but George missing from this business meeting, three of the Beatles are there. John says to Paul, I want a divorce. I want to walk away from the Beatles. I don't really need this anymore. And because of a delicate contractual negotiation, he's persuaded to keep quiet about it, so nothing is said. And in fact, the other three Beatles kind of wait for John, having walked away, as he does kind of walk back, but he never does. The following January, he's got another record called Instant Karma, and he just records that as Plastic Ono Band as well. And he's walked away from the Beatles. The following April 1970, Paul puts out his first solo album called McCartney, and the press copies of that have a little self Q&A in there on paper, a question and answer session, in which he makes it clear that the Beatles have essentially split up and that they aren't going to be recording together anymore. And that becomes then the headline, Beatles break up, April 1970. So next April, we're going to have the 50th anniversary of that, but really it's only the 50th anniversary of the press release, because at this point, by September 1969, the Beatles have broken up. They finished Abbey Road as a band, but by the time of its release, just 1 month later, discreetly, quietly, they've actually broken up. And so this photograph on the right-hand side here, taken at Tittenhurst Park on August 22, 1969, is the very last ever photograph of the four Beatles together. And for good measure, we have a photograph of the man taking the photograph. So that is the historic moment that's captured there, unknowingly, as it were. And that's it. The Beatles have broken up. And the most extraordinary thing about the Beatles is that they, throughout the 1960s, they have been continually reinventing themselves musically. They always had a great, strong, winning idea that sold millions of records and went straight to number one in the charts, and had the artistic bravery to ditch that when everybody else started copying and catching them up, and they would move on to something else. Now, when you're an artist and you have a winning formula, it's so easy just to stick to that and think, that's what we'll do, we'll keep making records that sound like that. And eventually, of course, the public will tire of them. But the Beatles knew that, and for their own sake as well, for their own interest levels, They just continually moved on and moved on and moved on. When they made Sgt. Pepper, they had no idea whether the audience would follow them. It was such a big step from what they'd been doing before. But no, the audience went with them and they were still number one on the charts. And so it was too with The Breakup. The hardest thing in the world is to know when to finish something. And the Beatles had been top since 1963, top in a way that no one had ever been top before. They had a level of fame that was absolutely secure, and a kind of level of fame that had never existed before they discovered it. But they knew when to finish it. John Lennon in particular knew, what are we going to do? Are we just going to gradually go downhill and have people say we're not as good as we used to be? So there they were, they made Abbey Road, it was a brilliant artistic achievement, and John Lennon just said, let's end it right there, like the Slash note that I want you, let's just finish it right there. And that to me is one of the reasons why the Beatles sustained to this day, because they had the bravery of very, very few artists to be cutting edge and mainstream at the same time, and to know how to finish. So the album did end with a track called The End. The Beatles finished with a track called The End, and Paul McCartney wrote the perfect lyric for it, and in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. And with that, and the way they sang it, and with the Abbey Road album, the Beatles really did go out on the highest of high notes.
And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make.
The grubby, I'm telling you.